Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you back at the end of the week for another weekly market recap, this time not featuring my friend Lance Roberts, featuring my even better friend, and let's admit it, folks, this is quite an upgrade, Lance's partner, Mike Leibowitz from Real Investment Advice. How you doing, Mike?
Great. Even Lance gets vacations now and again.
I can't believe you guys let that guy do that. I guess the bigger question is, did that guy ever do any real work, or is he just sort of on perpetual vacation there? The
question is, does he ever not do any work? The guy's always working. My guess is he probably is working right now on vacation.
He probably is. He's probably watching this. I just like to get my jabs in when I can, when he's not around.
Damn, yeah, I do too.
All right. Well, look, lots to talk about. We're going to talk an awful lot about two very important things. One is something you and I talk a lot about, and I don't think enough people talk enough about this, which is the lag effect from the very aggressive hiking and tightening campaigns that many of the world's central banks have been engaged in now for over a year. And related to that, we want to talk about what's going on in the bond market with rising yields, because yields are back on the move again. And of course, those are very tied to the lag effect, because the higher yields go, that what creates the impact of the lag effect.
Right.
Before we get there, though, let's just talk about the markets really quickly. Bit of a down week in the markets, not by too much, but you know, we've had a rollicking start to the year with at least the big stocks in the S&P. Things took a little breather this week. Anything notable about the market action this week?
The only thing worth noting was, I mean, it's a tough week because of the holiday. The thing worth noting was Thursday, we saw a decent decline on that very strong ADP number, the jobs number. Mm-hmm. They reported just under 500,000 new jobs were created in the economy. Now, the problem is the BLS came out on Friday morning and said that there were only 209,000 jobs, which is slightly above the average from 2015 to 2019. So the robust job growth in ADP is average job growth in the BLS world. So not sure there's much to make of employment data in general. It's not strengthening, but it's certainly not weakening either. And I believe that we are not going to have a recession until the labor market cools off. And there's nothing in this week's data between ADP, the BLS, we also had JOLTS, we had the ISM surveys. There's, other than manufacturing, which is probably in a recession, there's nothing else telling us that the labor market is going to turn into a recession. But things change rapidly. But based on the data looking backwards, it's fine. And Adam, let me remind you that most of the time the unemployment rate doesn't tick up until a recession has actually started. So it's not the leading indicator either. It's very much a lagging indicator.
Right. And frequent watchers of this channel have probably heard me reference many times the work of Michael Kantrowitz, who has the HOPE framework, which basically shows the progression of how we get into and out of recession. H stands for housing, O stands for new orders, P stands for profits or earnings for corporate companies. And the last one in the acronym is the E, is employment. Right. And that basically is the final domino. And if we look at the first three dominoes, you know, they have tipped over or in the process of tipping over. The last E there, the employment, has been the bulwark, and it's been surprisingly resilient. But as I've been reminding people many times, you know, sort of as goes the employment data, so goes the economy from here. Right. If it manages to hold steadily, and I think everybody is, I would say, I feel comfortable saying extremely surprised with how resilient the employment market's been so far. If it manages to remain solid, then we may not get this very predicted recession. And I'll be super clear, I'm one of the guys that still is predicting a recession here. What's interesting is that the employment data has been just amazingly good. And I showed a chart from one of your recent reports, Michael, last week with Lance, which shows the number of beats that we've had in the employment data. And you know, it's the kind of data where in a regular market, you know, 50% of the time it's going to beat, 50% of the time it's going to disappoint. Right. And I think the last data set, if I'm remembering correctly, is that we've now had 14 consecutive beats with that number. And so that's sort great. Of the equivalent of flipping a coin and getting heads 14 times in a row, right?
Well, this Friday's employment number was tails. So it's that streak is finally over.
Okay. So was it NFP numbers? Is that what that chart was measuring?
Yes. Yes. I think the expectation for Friday was 235 and it came in at 209. So, you know, the expectation was pretty much right on, but it was slightly over the actual number.
Okay. Well, that's notable then, because that is that one data point does not yet make a new trend, but it shows that we've had this incredible run of beats. Now we've had our first miss. Let's see what goes on from here. I know with the non-farm payroll numbers as well, not only did it disappoint when it came out on Friday, but they went back and fairly substantially revised downwards the previous couple of months as well.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, there's nothing in the data that tells you to run for the hills. The unemployment rate is still 3.6%, which is...
Yeah, it ticked down with this latest report.
Right, slightly above 50-year lows. The number I pay a little more, you know, BLS is the big number. Employment Friday, everyone talks about. I like jobless claims better. It's a weekly number. It's up to date. It's based on data, not on surveys. It's based on actual filings. Now, there are certainly some flaws in it. But when you look at like 4-week moving averages, I feel it gives a more reliable picture of what's happening in the real time. And if you look at jobless claims, they've upticked. And they're actually slightly higher than where they were for the couple of years before the pandemic. But again, they're not ramping higher. I guess you could call it a slow grind higher. And the second part of that is continuing claims. So people get laid off. How long do they continue to collect jobless claims? And continuing claims, too, don't show you that these people are getting laid off and not finding jobs. They're finding jobs, you know, relatively quickly. So that's what I like to follow closest. But you can't focus on every Thursday's number. You got to kind of take two steps back and look at the trends and look at where it's going. So that, you know, that's another data point your listeners, viewers can use to kind of track the labor markets.
Yeah. And you know, we've had a lot of discussion on this channel of how much can we really lean into these numbers? How much can we really trust them? Because there is a lot of, you know, some of these numbers at times are sort of hard to believe. The beats are multiple sigma, you know, multiple right. sigma multiples. Right. And oftentimes there's pretty big discrepancies, even with different surveys run by the same organizations. Right. There's the household and the establishment surveys that are done by the BLS that have had a pretty big divergence in the order of millions of jobs for much of the past 12 plus months running. One of the data points I like to look at is, I'm trying to remember this, if I get this correct, it's basically taxes withheld, payroll taxes withheld, right. Because that's reported daily by the U.S. Treasury. And so that's if somebody's getting a check, you know, you have to tell the government how much you want withheld in taxes from that paycheck. Right. So it's not a calculated algorithm like the birth death models and the BLS. Models they use, it's just a report of, hey, we withheld X many taxes today. Right. And that number has actually been declining in growth pretty radically over the past year. And the last time I saw the data set, and I'll try to find it and put it up here if I can, is that it was cracking into negative growth. So that sort of shows that at least the trajectory of employment is, you know, perhaps heading in a direction that the headlines maybe still don't tell us, you know, the headlines might right. still be a little bit deceiving on the upwardly rosy side of things. And there's, you know, lots of debate on, you know, most of the job growth that's being reported is in part-time jobs. I think for much of 2022, I don't know if there was any growth net. I think we might have actually lost full-time jobs net. So there's a lot of dust in the air here. But it's worth looking from every angle we can, to your point. We shouldn't just look at it, the payroll report or the JOLTS report or ADP, we should be looking at all these different things because employment is so important to where things go from here. In fact, I think if there's only two things we had to look at, I'd want to look at liquidity in the market and I'd want to look at employment. I think those two things will probably tell us more of where the economy is headed than anything else.
Right. And look, bottom line is you can look at all the data till you're blue in the face. How many people do you know that have been let go and can't find a job? That's another great indicator. And I don't know anyone at the moment. In fact, my daughter is in New York City for the summer. She's in college and she's interning. She has a marketing internship, but she needs to make some money. So she, first, second day she gets there, she walks down the street. She pops in a 5 or 6 restaurants. She ends the day with 5 or 6 offers. I mean, these, a lot of the job growth is coming from the entertainment and the food industry. Service.
Yeah.
And, you know, they clearly need help. You know, why, you know, we can ask the question, why are people eating out so much more? Is that what's going on? Or are they just can't hire enough employees? But there's clearly strength in certain industries, and they're not high quality job industries. You know, restaurants, for the most part, and entertainment tend not to be higher paying jobs. They tend to be tend to fire very quickly, hire very quickly, a lot of volatility in the workforce. So, you know, that's just another thing. It's just, what do you see on the ground? Does the data, all these reams of data, jibe with what you actually see? And what I see is a very strong labor market.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. And actually, I'm going to invite viewers here to share their observations in the comment section below this video so that we can get some real-time kind of crowdsourcing of information, hopefully from across the country and maybe other countries as well. I will say out where I am, I'm in Northern California, up in the San Francisco Bay Area region. I would say similar with sort of like, you know, lower pay scale service jobs, you know, lots of demand. You know, lots of help wanted signs still out there at these places. I will say though, with more of the white collar level, the you know, executive manager, director level, you know, mid level management, I'm definitely hearing more stories and actually seeing more people I know beginning to get laid off. Some quite high in like the C suite or the SVP suite, you know, for the past 6 months or so, they haven't seemed too worried, largely because these guys were getting, you know, 6+ months of severance. They're getting very generous severance packages and they were kind of resting and recovering for a little bit before looking for work. But I do know some where I think I'm beginning to see sort of, you know, a little bit of beads of sweat on the forehead of like, I'm having trouble finding a job that pays as well or maybe has the same title that my previous one had. This is all anecdotal, but to your point of looking around, I do sort of see that discrepancy between the lower end of the pay scale and the higher end.
Right. And here's another thing to think about. Your neighbor loses his $1 million, you know, SVP job, 10 people are hired to work in a restaurant at, you know, the equivalent of what, 30, 40,000 a year. The number of jobs just increased significantly, but the quality of job decreased. So that's where all these numbers kind of are, you can't just compare one to another because they all measure slightly different things. So, you know, it's just something else to factor in is quality.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was saying earlier. We have to kind of look at this jobs number from all different ways, because if we just look at the headlines, I think the story is a little bit deceptive, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's certainly the quality of the type of jobs tells you more of a clearer story of what's really going on with the economy here, right? And fair or not, you know, there are a lot of types of jobs. Trying to remember who I interviewed on this channel who said, like, the average tech worker, like it or not, their job basically enables like 5 or 6 jobs in their local economy, or not even necessarily in their local economy. But, you know, you've got one large scale tech manager. You know, there's the coffee shop that they go, you know, get their coffee out in the morning. There's the contractors that they're farming out, you know, vendor-based projects to, stuff like that. That big job goes away. a lot of those smaller jobs suffer as well. So you got to look at those interconnectivities too.
Right. And okay. You know, one other kind of odd aspect that we've been seeing is manufacturing versus service sector. Manufacturing job, I think there were 42,000 jobs were lost. I didn't see what it was in BLS, but that's been a continuing theme that the manufacturing sector is losing jobs while the service sector is gaining jobs. So a lot of people will say, well, that's fine because manufacturing is roughly 20-25% of the economy. Service is 3/4 or so of the economy. The problem is many service sector jobs are, for lack of a better word, non-volatile, right? Teachers don't get fired. Doctors don't get fired. We go to school, whether we're in a depression or a booming economy, we go see doctors. So there's a lot of service sector jobs that are not going anywhere, that are not really representative of economic activity. So, you know, you do have a quarter of the population or so that is seeing job losses, or a quarter of the economy, seeing job losses. But the question is, of those service sector jobs, which ones are marginal? Like restaurant jobs are marginal. When business slows down, they will let go of the wait staff and the chefs and the, you know, whoever else is working there. So that's important to remember the distinction between those two, because I think it's getting a lot of press and we need to understand what it really means, at least on the labor front.
Yeah. And on that same point, I did an interview a few weeks ago with Lakshman Achuthan. Mm-hmm. And he, if I'm remembering correctly, said, yeah, our U.S. economy is basically 2/3 or whatever services now. But he said the manufacturing jobs, they punch above their weight in terms of their impact on the economy. And he said, if I remember the factor right, it was like 5 or 6 times, right? It was the multiplier. So if you add that up, even at its still, you know, current rate of 20 or 30% or whatever it is, you multiply that by 5 or 6, it's actually greater in terms of its ultimate impact than the current services.
Right. And what he's probably talking about is the correlation to economic activity.
Yeah.
That there's a very high correlation in manufacturing jobs to economic activity, both hiring and firing, whereas a lot of service sector, there's not nearly as much correlation. You know, like I said, doctors aren't losing jobs in a recession. Teachers don't lose jobs. There's plenty of other service sector industries that don't get fired if there's a recession, whereas manufacturing is all but guaranteed that those companies will make adjustments.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting about the manufacturing job decline that you've been talking about, which has been going on for a while, is we have the inflation. Well, we have the whole reshoring trend that's going on right now. Right. And we also have funds that are getting spent now by the Inflation Reduction Act. And we're seeing construction jobs grow pretty dramatically now, and I think that that's largely coming from that, right? It's the building of, you know, new businesses, new roads, etc. Right now, I'm wondering if that will eventually spill over into manufacturing, where once that new infrastructure is built, that it'll enable more manufacturing to be done. But certainly, the money's not flowing there yet because we're still seeing contraction here in the manufacturing sector.
Right. And construction, certain parts of like new home construction is booming right now. You know, at least parts of this country, we're seeing a boom in multifamily construction. You know, the question is, are they getting ahead of themselves? And will there be enough renters, or buyers of those multifamily properties to justify the existence, or will we have an overhang? And that overhang then starts having a big effect on labor, on prices, on the economy.
Well, let's use that as our segue then into the main event of this discussion, because just like with the overall economy, certainly within housing, so much of it's going to depend upon what happens with employment, right? Mm-hmm. Because housing prices, in theory at least, should be a function of what local incomes can support,
right?
Yeah, in theory. So I mentioned in the intro that we were going to talk about the lag effect, right? Mm-hmm. We have had, you know, arguably the most aggressive hiking slash tightening campaign, you know, in history in terms of the time frame that it's been done in, over the past 14 months or so. And things are holding together still really well. You know, the economy is still going well. Employment's still on paper really strong. Markets are back, you know, beginning to see their all-time highs, you know, in their headlights. You know, the fleet of zombie corporations are all still largely alive. I mean, so the market, and I would say the media, the financial media, is kind of beginning to adopt this attitude of like, like what lag effect, right? Now, of course, by definition, the lag effect means it's something that shows up later. And so the big question is how material is the lag effect going to be, right? I think you and I probably have a greater respect for its potential, perhaps, than many folks that are trading stocks daily right now or writing these financial headlines. But let's really dig into this, because everything that we've just been talking about, its future will be determined basically about what the intensity of the lag effect is going to be.
Right.
So I've seen lots of debate in terms of how long the lag effect of Fed policy is. And just for new viewers, what we're talking about is the Fed pulls a lever, right? It increases the federal funds rates by 25 basis points, for example. You don't really see the impact in the economy of that change, that incremental change in the rate until some period of time. And I've seen estimates of anywhere from 9 months to 2 years, you know, kind of going in between the two. You get about where we are right now. So first off, Michael, how do you look at the duration of when we should expect to see a lag effect from a Fed action?
Right. So there's a lot of different levers going on here. Like you said, the Fed has increased rates at the fastest rate. So how much and over what period of time since like the early 1980s? But now this is very important. When you factor in how much and how quickly they did it with the amount of debt in the economy, you could say that the current environment, the Fed is blowing away what they did in the 80s because it was so much less debt. The interest rate had so much less of an effect because there's just a lot less debt. So what the Fed is doing is, if I would have told you this a year ago, what they would do, you'd think I was crazy. And it hasn't worked yet.
Right. And just to be clear, I would have thought the economy would have gone into like cardiac arrest by now.
Well, and I probably said that to you a year ago. So why hasn't it? So there's a lot of different things going on. So first of all, we can look at housing. Why hasn't housing cratered if mortgage rates are now 7%? And part of the problem with housing is that you need a buyer and a seller. And if I want to sell my house, for instance, I can sell it, but can the buyer afford it with the mortgage rate? And even if the buyer can afford it, I have to go live somewhere else. So rent prices are up. So I can rent at a very high price, or I can buy another house and take out a 7 or 8% mortgage to buy that other house. And you could make a case where you could sell a house for $500,000, turn around, buy a house for $400,000, and have a larger mortgage payment than you did before. So the housing, the existing housing market, not new homes, but existing homes, is very stagnant. There's just nothing going on, which helps explain why new homes are doing relatively well, why both construction and new home purchases are doing well, because those are the only homes available. And there are people that want to buy homes, need to buy homes.
And let me just clarify what's going on there for folks. So you've got this sort of freezing of the existing home market, whereas Michael's saying you have people that don't want to sell because they don't want to basically have to have a more expensive house going forward when you take into account the higher mortgage rates, right? So transactions there have pretty much frozen up. What the new home builders are able to do is they're able to slightly undercut the price, or at least the value of these frozen prices in the existing home market. So they're able to do a lot of turnover at just a little bit of a discount to the existing home market. And they're still capturing the vast majority of the profit they would make if they were selling it at exactly the same level. So they actually have this really nice competitive window of opportunity where they can sell a lot of inventory in at close to what the prevailing market rate is. So that's why, you know, when I first heard this, I was like, gosh, why are new homes being able to, you know, why are the home builders doing so well? Now that I sort of understand that dynamic, I kind of get it.
Right. And it's also a much smaller percentage of the whole housing market, too.
Right.
So, you know, you got to put them both together. You can't just look at either one individually and make a presumption.
Right. But you, sorry to interrupt again, but you have this demand that's getting pent up, right, of people that want to buy a house and transactions aren't happening. So these new houses are coming on at a slightly better value. And so all that growing demand is chasing that. And of course, you're saying, oh, wait, I can actually get a new house, you know, that was just built today with all new fixtures and, right, you know, I don't have to worry about termite damage or any of the things I might have to worry about with an older home. And I'm, you know, so the market is running towards that, what it perceives as a better value right now.
Right. So that's just one example, you know, but then you can look at like cars. If you don't need to buy a car, you don't really know what auto lending rates are. You know, cars last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So in theory, only, you know, a small percentage of those that need to buy cars are out there in the market and affected by the higher rates. Corporations are big borrowers, but unless their debt matures or they have to borrow new money, they don't care what the rates are today. They care what they're going to be when that debt matures. The corporations tend to roll over debt. So if they issue a five-year note, the debt matures and they issue a new five-year note. So there hasn't been a lot of corporate debt that's matured thus far in 2023. That number starts ramping up later in 23 and 24. So that's the lag effect. That's why it takes a while. Now you also have the stimulus effect. So the government flooded the economy with money in so many different ways. And some of that stimulus is still flowing through. Student loans are still, you still don't have to make payments on a student loan. That'll change in, you know, in theory, if Biden can't do anything in August, where all of a sudden that, you know, a lot of people are going to be paying $300, $400, $500 and even more towards their student loan that they weren't paying for the last three and a half years. There's still a slight excess of savings. If you look at total savings and kind of the trend rate of savings, they are still running above trend. So consumers are able to draw down savings. Credit card uses has increased, credit card balances have increased rapidly. So consumers are also using credit cards to help spend as well. So, you know, and then there's this whole psychological aspect of the pandemic. We saw UNH reported that they're a little concerned because their older clients are starting to go to elective surgery. Because of the pandemic, they were shying away from that. So a lot of these pent up demands, behaviors from the last 3 years are coming to fruition. We didn't go on a vacation for 2 years. Let's do it up this year. Let's go on a bigger vacation. You know, we deserve it because it's been 2 years, that sort of thing. So you throw all these different factors into the, you know, the pot and you stir them up, makes it very hard to predict when the economy will eventually feel the effect of the rate hikes. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think what we really have to remember is that we are in an economy that grows at 1.5 to 2%. After inflation. That's not me. That's the Fed that tells you that. If you look at their long run projections, I think it's 1.7, 1.8%. If you look at productivity growth in this country, it's about the same thing. Demographics don't do the economy any favors, and it just kind of gets worse as time goes on. And it all comes back to credit then. Credit's that marginal lever. And with rates so high and the yield curve inverted, the banks don't necessarily want to lend money and people don't want to borrow money at these high rates. So, you know, it's kind of, I feel like we're like the coyote and the Roadrunner.
Mm-hmm.
The coyote runs off, Wile E. Coyote runs off the cliff, and he's sitting there and he looks around. He thinks everything's okay. And then he looks down and the bottom drops. And, you know, it's really, it's always hard to predict the lag effect. This, because of all these different stimuluses and behaviors and everything going on, this is just so much harder. But it means that this lag effect can last longer. I think that's the big risk, is that the coyote stays in the air longer and the Fed keeps raising rates. They're piling on to the damage that we don't see. And I think that's really what is concerning the Fed. The Fed, I think, would love not to raise rates anymore.
Right.
They've put themselves in a corner where they almost have to now.
I'm sorry to chuckle, but as you were talking, I was seeing the Roadrunner cartoon in my head. And and there are times where, like, he's chasing the Roadrunner, you know, with like an anvil, and he runs off the cliff and he's in the air and then he looks down and then he falls. Right. And then the anvil hangs up there for a few more extra seconds. So he lands, he falls and makes the big pile of dust at the bottom of the ravine. And then, you know, a second later, the anvil goes and lands on him. Right. And that's kind of like the Fed's over tightening. Right.
Well, and that's a great analogy. The more they over tighten, the bigger the anvil.
Yeah. Yeah. The analogy I've used, and I'd be curious to hear if you think this is true, is imagine somebody walking down the road. And you're watching them with binoculars, and you determine that person is moving too fast for your liking, right? So this is the Fed looking at the economy and saying, okay, you know what, the economy, it's getting a little too hot, right? So you send a runner with a backpack and a weight and say, go catch up to that guy, put this backpack on and put the weight in the backpack, right? So your runner does that and you're watching and you're saying, oh, no, the guy's still moving faster than I want. So you send another runner out. And after a while, you're like, no, I'm going to send another runner because I think I'm going to need more weight. And you keep sending runners out. As each runner arrives, they keep putting more and more weight into the backpack of the guy. So he finally does start slowing. And then maybe when the next runner catches up to him, it's too much weight and he stops. Then the next runner comes, gives him even more weight. Still, he now falls to the ground. You may still have like five or six runners that are in progress. And now the guy's on the ground, he can't move, and runners are still arriving and putting more and more weight on him, right? That's the danger you get into with over-tightening, where you might say, oh my gosh, I've done too much, but you still have a bunch of runners that you've sent out, right?
Right, right. And that's exactly right. And the Fed knows this. Jerome Powell, I think it was last week in front of, his congressional testimony, he made statements. Maybe it wasn't congressional testimony, but he made statements. He said, we have to be very respectful that a lot of our rates have not taken full effect yet. So he's telling you that he's mentioned the lag effect many times.
He's been mentioning it for the whole year of tightening.
He has. And in a weird way, I kind of feel bad for them because they have to keep piling on, making that anvil bigger and bigger. And they have to know that the bottom by definition will fall out. This is basically economic physics. You can't have a 2% economy with 5% interest rates. The math just doesn't work. And we are so highly levered, the math even gets worse. So it's a question of when. And I know it's frustrating from those that are in bonds. It can be frustrating for those that are kind of sitting out or less exposed in the stock market. It's frustrating, but this can go on for a while. And that's why it's important to kind of follow what the markets are telling you, watch the economic data, respect the lags, respect kind of the broader macro theme of, you know, where this country's been heading for the last 30 years, and kind of put all that together into a cohesive plan of action. So, look, I think we both agree the future looks poor, but that doesn't mean that the next 2 months can't be really good for the stock market or really bad for the bond market. It's, you know, you're dealing with sentiment and investor behaviors versus to some degree reality. And most investors are backward looking. And if you look backward, this is kind of how we led off. there's no more lag effect. Lag effect is gone. Interest rates don't matter. Everything's good. Look, the economy withstood 5% interest rates. We're good. That's not the truth. That's not what's going to happen. So you have to just keep all this stuff in mind and balance, you know, try to be very, you know, have your opinions, but read and watch and listen to the bulls, to the bears, and try to understand what they're all saying and why the bulls may be right for a while, but why they may be wrong. And conversely, maybe the lag effects are going to be much longer. Maybe we're talking another year or two, right? So try to understand and gain conviction by looking at basically both sides of the aisle.
So Michael, you just really underscored why we have you and your partner Lance on this channel week after week, is to give people a continued ongoing viewpoint into the mind of a capital manager, because you don't have the luxury of just sitting here and opining. You actually have to make capital allocation decisions for your clients based upon what's going on. And it's a challenge, because the theme all year has been that the market performance has been very divergent from what the macro data has been telling us, right? And so, you know, you mentioned the coyote can be remain in the air much longer, you know, than you think. And it's the same thing as the old quote of the market can remain irrational for, you know, longer than you can remain solvent. And Lance always tells us, look, yes, we can opine all day about what we think should happen, but you have to trade the market that you have, right? Not the market that you wish you had, right? So totally get all that. I am going to ask you a bit later about how your recent decisions in terms of trading and positioning of your portfolios and whatnot. But we still have more road to hoe before we get there. And I want to get back on for a second. What you think the Fed may do here and the dangers of over tightening, because from the math of just base effects alone, it does seem that CPI will likely rise over the rest of this summer. Right, when you have the comparisons from July to July of next year, highly likely that that's going to be positive CPI year over year basis, and that's going to inch the CPI rate back up again. That will probably, I mean, I know the Fed has done the math. I'm sure they've got all those PhDs. Hopefully, they've done this pretty simple math. If that indeed happens, I just think optically, it's going to be really hard for the Fed not to feel pressure, increased pressure, to be perceived like it's doing more, especially with, you know, as we talked about earlier, you know, the nothing seems to be wrong with the labor market, right? It's got stock markets still, you know, again, not too far from all-time highs. And if inflation looks to the world like it's going to be stickier than the world has been expecting because it starts inching back up again, I don't know. I could see Powell, who has already said, look, we're going to do two more hikes, folks. He may say, hey, we might have to add a few more.
Yes, absolutely. But who has gotten inflation right over the last 3 years? So, you know, I know we think, you know, we have opinions on what inflation is going to do. 1/3 of the CPI number is housing. So if you look at the shelter, it's called shelter. The shelter component of CPI, it is still rising. Every other gauge of housing prices, Case-Shiller, all the different rent, Redfin, a whole host of indicators show that house price gains and rent gains have been arrested. They're flat, in some cases falling. So at some point, the BLS, who calculates CPI, will catch up with them.
Right.
And that's 1/3 of the CPI number. CPI, I think it's next Wednesday or this coming Wednesday, is supposed to, on a year-over-year basis, this is the headline number, which includes everything, fall from 4% to about 3.1-3.2%. 3.2% isn't that bad. I mean, it's not the 2% they want, but it's not the 8-10% we saw a year ago.
Right.
Right. So that's not bad. PPI is going to come out the following day or 2 days. PPI could be zero or negative year over year growth. I think the expectation is 0.2. Now the Fed is looking at core, and they're kind of coming up with these wacky variations of CPI. Core service sector CPI without housing. right? Core service sector CPI is sticky. I think it's, you know, rough closer to 5%, 4.5%, and it's sticky. But, you know, this is where the Fed is almost trying to make a case to the market that we're trying to find these parts of CPI that are remaining sticky so that we can validate, so that we can stay higher for longer, because we are scared that inflation could resurface. So, but at the end of the day, CPI represents a wide basket of goods. That's going to be 3%, not awful. And if you look at kind of the monthly growth, which I actually like to do better, the expectation is 0.2% for the month. 0.2% for a month is 2.4% inflation annualized. And it's been running kind of between, I think, between 1/10 and like 3 or 4/10. So, you know, the inflation rate is probably closer to 2.5, 3.5%. Yes, there are sticky components, but overall, the stuff that we buy is, it's still rising in price. Let's be honest here. It's still rising in price, just not at the same rate.
Just not at the rate.
It was rising. And we're not getting back that 8% jump. It's not like you should expect it to come all the way back, prices to be back where they were in 2019. That's not going to happen. But in economics, we talk about growth rates. The Fed focuses on growth rates. And so, yes, parts of inflation will remain sticky. There's no doubt. And, you know, we have yet to see what's going to happen. But the trend is certainly lower. And if you look at some of these ISM gauges and other gauges of inflation, there's nothing overly concerning that inflation will not continue to at least stay where it's at and possibly trend lower. Maybe it can uptick a little bit over the coming months, but the monthly data is starting to become more friendly. And, you know, I think at some point it allows the Fed to step back, which is what I think they tried to do at the last meeting. We're not going to do anything. Let's just wait and see. And unfortunately for them, economic activity was pretty strong, and they have to appear strong, appear in charge of the situation, willing to do whatever it takes.
And that's sort of the concern, the potential concern I was raising, which is if the CPI after the June numbers come out, which should be lower, like you said, if the CPI starts to tick up for a couple of months, even if you and I might think, okay, that's going to be transitory. Right. I'm just wondering if it's going to put enough optical pressure on the Fed to look like it's in control, that it's got to announce some additional tightening just to sort of show that, hey, we're not going to, you know, we're on top of this, folks. But it's like adding yet another anvil, you know, above the coyote.
Right. And we wrote a commentary a day or two ago. You can go on our website and look it up. And we looked at real 2-year rates. So real rates are the yield on a 2-year note minus I used 5-year rates. The yield on the 5-year rate minus the implied inflation. So you can back into the TIPS markets and bond markets and figure out what inflation rate the market thinks will happen over the next 5 years, not the next 3 months, like we're kind of talking about, but five years. And 5 years is a very good gauge of the economy. That's where a lot of corporate loans occur, auto loans. Believe it or not, the duration on a mortgage is much closer to 5 than 30 years. So a lot of borrowing kind of occurs in that 5-year period. Right now, the spread on the 5-year treasury minus the 5-year implied inflation rate is over 2%. If you go back and look from the post-financial crisis era up to the pandemic, that number was by and large negative, meaning the Fed was trying to push the economy, trying to push for growth. They had very easy policy. We now have the most restrictive policy we've had since 2007. When you're looking at this on a 5-year real rate basis, the last time we were up here was 2007, and that real yield got up to, I think it was 2.5%. We're at 2.10%. So we're not that far off. But this goes back to what I said earlier. The amount of debt in the system has significantly increased since 2007. So the effect of that real rate is much more now than it was then. So we're getting to the point where we're there. The Fed is extremely restrictive already on the economy. And I feel like we just need some time to let some of these other things work themselves through. That basically the lag effect just has to work itself through. And, you know, I think inflation will fall when the economy will fall rapidly. And, you know, you can laugh, but I think it wouldn't be shocking a year from now, we're in a recession and the Fed's worried about how they're going to get the inflation rate back up to 2%.
Right. And just to let you know, I mean, we've had a number of other people on this program who think that that's the likely scenario, right? You've got folks like Stephanie Pomboy, who has just been beating the drum that, look, we got to be really much more focused on the deflation that she thinks we're going to have soon versus the remaining inflation. You've got guys like Lacey Hunt that have done an excellent job with data to show that the bigger existential problem that the U.S. economy faces is a deflationary one. It has had to put down its deflationary sword to fight a hungrier inflation dragon that has showed up in the short term. But as soon as it slays that one, it's got to pick that deflation sword right back up.
Right. And but that's an important point. That inflation dragon was not based on the economic trends of the last 30 years, based on the kind of the economy as we have it.
Right.
It was based on a one-off event. It's as if Martians landed on this planet and did all kinds of, spent all kinds of money or did all kinds of crazy stuff. And then they flew away. Well, that's what the pandemic was. It just hit us out of nowhere. It hit the world out of nowhere. It shut down economies, which we've never seen anything like that, economic shutdowns. People couldn't travel. They couldn't, factories were shutting down. You couldn't spend money. And then at the same time, the government is flooding the system, both financial system and individuals and corporations with money to spend. They had nowhere to spend it. And then you got all the behavioral aspects to this. Like, okay, we're free now. We're free from the pandemic. Let's go spend money. But everyone's on a different scale. Some people were ready July of 2020 to go on a cruise. Other people are finally getting willing enough to get on a cruise today. So it just works itself through in very, unpredictable ways. But that is and was a one-time event. Now, there's something a little different about that one-time event is that the Fed or the Treasury learned how to print money. They learned how to do stimulus, get the Fed to back them up, and basically hand money to people, shower the citizens with money. My concern is, yes, we're in a deflationary economy, broadly speaking, notwithstanding the last few years. My concern is that whoever's in charge, I don't think it matters whether, because one of the money drops happened under Trump and one under Biden.
Yeah.
So yeah. They're both capable.
Show me the political party that doesn't love to spend money when they can.
Exactly. So my concern is that we get into a recession and they want to give every citizen $300. They want to follow that up with another $500. We know how that ends, right? It's going to be another inflationary bout. So as we look forward, I wouldn't say that we're going to be in a deflationary bout for 10 years. Because there's a new political financial concern that the powers that be basically learned how to buy votes a different way, a new way, and that's money printing.
Yeah, I really want to dig more further into that with you, but let me hold off for a moment.
Going off on tangents.
But let me say I sadly agree with you that I think we have open that box, and it very well may be a Pandora's box. And it's certainly, once you give a politician a tool that especially helps them curry favor in the short term with the electorate, they don't ever want to put that tool down again. In fact, they want to use it as often as they're able to.
Right.
But sticking at a high level here on the lag effect, before we move on to a few other things, you did a good job of, I think, summarizing kind of four things that are that explain where we are right now in the story. But all of them are transitory, right? And this is what I think gives you confidence that that the macro data is going to win out in the long run here. One, you talked about, you know, we issued all the stimulus, right? But there's still some of it left sloshing around, and it's big enough to be material, right? This is the pig in the python that Lance and I talk about all the time. And I wish there were a really good metric that told us exactly how much pig was left in the python. We can't, you know, there's all different ways people estimate it, but it hasn't fully passed through, and there's enough there that's still propping up certain elements of the economy and to a certain extent the financial markets. Then we have the sort of the easy legacy or the low cost legacy debt mm-hmm. that consumers, but mostly I think in this case corporations took out, you know, a year or a few years ago when rates were a lot lower, right? So they can coast on that as well, right? The problem with both of those is that at some point the pig's through the python, right? No more support there, right? Secondly, with the credit, you have fairly violent events of re-rating, right? Okay, you've used up the capital that was cheap. Now you have to go out and get more, and bow, bang, wow, look how much higher it is right now, right? So you kind of have these step functions where all of a sudden you could do something and then you can afford to do a lot less in a very short period of time, right? And there's going to be like rolling thunder of that going forward as, you know, especially in corporate America, as corporations have to refinance on whatever their debt schedules are. The third thing you mentioned was credit financing. So a lot of consumers are now switching from their own personal, as their own personal pig is passed through their own personal python, they are deciding to still maintain their same standard of living. They're just turning to revolving credit to fund it, mm-hmm. right? And we've seen the credit card balances shoot the moon again after going down for a couple of years as folks were getting checks in the mail and whatnot. And so again, that's something that sort of has an expiration date, because you can only lever up such to the point that if you take on more debt, you're now unable to service the existing debt that you have. So mm-hmm. there's that limiter, or there's the limiter of the credit card companies, the credit providers just saying, hey, we're not lending to you anymore. You're no longer a good credit risk, right? So we know that has an end to it. And then last, you talked about the sort of revenge spending, right? Oh, we've been sort of stuck at home for years, and now I'm going to go out and finally treat myself and take that cruise. Again, that's a bolus of spending that has an expiration date. Once it's gone, you know, the revenge is over. So we kind of have these four big things that have been propping things up, and we don't have great measures of when each one kind of tips from the green into the red. But as more time goes on, we can get more confident that each of them is a lot closer to the red here. So I just wanted to really clarify that for folks, because some of these things you just can't avoid. And unless there's like another massive stimulus program, that pig is going to get through the python. until rates dramatically go down again, credit's going to re-rate at much higher cost than it was before. At some point, as I mentioned, the credit financing is going to dry up, and this revenge spending will be over probably quite soon. So you can look at all those things and say, okay, yeah, you know, we can't fool ourselves for too much longer if those are the four pillars we're building our bullish case on.
Right. And here's another big factor that we haven't talked about. I wrote about it a couple weeks ago, and it's the banks. And money is created by banks. Banks lend money, and that's how money is created. It's not really printed at the Fed. The Treasury really doesn't print it. A new loan, a new debt is money creation. So when the Treasury spent, you know, X trillion showering us with money, that was money creation. That's a new loan. They borrowed money from the Treasury markets. So banks create money, right? Banks drive the economy with lending. There is a strong correlation between bank credit and GDP. So, and it makes sense. If you have an economy driven by bank credit.
By credit, the credit issuers determine what the economy is going to do. Absolutely.
Right. So let's put ourselves in the shoes of a banker, right? First of all, to make Adam a loan, I'm taking money from you, right? Your deposits, you deposit $1,000 and I can lend Adam out about $900. That's great. right? That works well because I'm paying you next to nothing and Adam's paying me 8% to borrow the money.
Yeah. And hey, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just got to ask this. So you're basing that on the 90%, this is what's called fractional reserve lending, right? Is you put in 1,000, you can loan up to 900 to somebody else off that initial 1,000. I've heard that during the pandemic, the reserve ratios were brought down to zero. So could you literally take $1,000 from somebody else and then lend the full 1,000 to the next person?
I guess you could, but there's also other restrictions on banks that they would never do that. But yes, in theory.
Okay.
But their leverage ratios, I ran this a few months ago, are like nine. They're less than 10 times levered. So they are doing it at about the same rate.
Okay. So they haven't gone hog wild, even though the reserve ratio was brought to zero.
Because there are other ratios they have to adhere to.
All right. Sorry to interrupt, but I know some people have had that question.
Right. No. So that's a good point, though. So let's think about what's going on. I'm taking your deposit at zero because my money markets still pay close to zero, and I'm lending it to Adam at 8. So I make 8%. Well, all of a sudden you say, well, why do I have my money in a bank at zero? I'm going to go buy a treasury bill at 5%. That money goes away. The only way for me to, I have two options at this point. I can sell another bank Adam's loan, or I can get a new deposit. Well, unfortunately for banks, new deposits are much closer to current interest rates. So that new deposit rate may be 5%. So Adam comes to me for a second loan and says, hey, I need to borrow money. And I'm like, Adam, I'm borrowing money at 5%. I can't lend you any more money, 8%. That doesn't cover all my costs. Plus, I'm losing deposits. So I have to sell assets. I can't add more assets when I'm trying to sell assets. So the bottom line is, and I created a proxy. It's in that article from 2 weeks ago about the yield curve that basically looks at the shape of the yield curve. So what does it cost to borrow, to borrow short and to lend long? And it looks at credit spreads. And it basically says that the bank's incentive to lend is the lowest it's been in basically, I forgot how far back I go, but a long time. So banks are not incented to lend. And then when you factor in that they're still losing deposits and they have to sell assets, that makes them even less likely to lend money. And this isn't just my conjecture. This is, if you look at bank lending standards from all, credit cards, mortgages, commercial industrial loans, those are corporate loans, the whole slate, their lending standards are tight. They're basically tightening their lending standards. So the engine for the economy, credit, is slowing down rapidly. We're running out of gas, so to speak. That too takes a while because if you don't need to borrow money until November, who cares what the bank's doing today? But as you know, as this situation continues, and the problem just met, so rates, a slew of rates, long-term rates just went over 4%, and short-term treasury rates just went over 5%. That makes headlines, that makes cocktail conversations. What do you do with your money? Oh, I just bought a 6-month bill at 5.25%. Oh, where do I get one of those? And how do I do that? Oh, just take your money from the bank, send it to Fidelity and buy it, or just buy an ETF that kind of mimics that. This was like, you remember those inflation I-bonds? I think it was I-bonds.
Yeah, I remember I-bonds.
They were all the rage because they paid 9, 10, 11%. Well, consumers are slowly but surely figuring this out. And I've helped my mom, help my brother-in-law and a few other friends. How do I get my money from a bank to a Fidelity and what do I buy? And it seems to me and you, it seems pretty easy, but it can be complicated and daunting to do if you don't really know what a treasury bill is and what the restrictions are and how to buy it and what difference between price and coupon and yield and what does all that mean? It can be daunting, but slowly but surely, people are doing the math and saying, even if I have $100,000, that's an extra $5,000 a year of income I can make on the money. So you have a slow drain of deposits from banks. You have a yield curve that does no favors for them. And you have banks that basically have no incentive or very little incentive to lend money. And again, if you're going to, you have an economy that's based on debt, that's a huge headwind that will slowly but surely increase against the economy.
Okay, great points. Let me just mention a few things. One is to your point about I-bonds. Yes, I actually talked a lot about them on this channel back when they were yielding 9%. Longtime viewers probably remember my explainer videos on those. I also did an explainer video on how to buy T-bills. And so if you're interested at all in what Michael was saying and thinking, oh gosh, I've got money sitting in the bank earning next to nothing, I'd love to be making 5%+ on that. I'll put up a link to that video here. You can watch it after this video if you want to. So one thing you didn't mention, Michael, was some of the other shoes that are set to drop for the banking system. A big one that folks are watching closely right now is commercial real estate loans. Mm-hmm. These smaller banks, which is where the trouble has been so far this year. And by smaller banks, I mean really any bank in the U.S. that's not in like the top eight. They have, uncharacteristically, most other loan types, the big banks have a bigger presence in, but it's actually the smaller banks that have the majority of the commercial real estate mortgages out there. And, for many understandable reasons, folks are expecting that loan book to be in a world of hurt relatively soon. Right. So that's probably just going to tighten things even, more further that you're talking about, the steps the banks are having to take here. So Jerome Powell himself has said, hey, bank lending standards have been tightening post, the banking wobbles that we saw earlier this year, Silicon Valley Bank, et cetera. And he said those act as additional, they substitute for additional rate hikes on our end. Right. So that's one of the reasons why he did the skip was, hey, we want to see what the impact of the lag effect of what we've done is, but we also want to see what the lag effect of these bank tightening standards are. So I just to make sure folks are understanding how to view all this, it's like the coyote, is in danger of falling. Then we have the Fed's over tightening, being an anvil or cluster of anvils that are falling down on him. And then on top of that, we may have a couple of pianos, that are going to fall on him that are coming from the banking system.
Bowling balls, correct.
Yeah. So I'm not sure everybody really puts all those pieces together all the time, but there is an awful lot of gravity, potential gravity in the situation that can finally start pulling things down here. And again, the risk I think that you and I are most concerned about is because we think that's likely to happen, right? And I don't want to put words in your mouth, correct me, but I think we think that the gravitational pull of all of these contractionary issues we're talking about is going to slow the economy here and start bringing asset prices down along with it. The problem is there may be way more anvils, pianos, and bowling balls that come along with it that could bring this down much further than anybody wants. Right. Consumers, businesses, the policymakers themselves.
Right. Let's put ourselves in Jerome Powell's shoes for a second. I bet that if we had him here and, he was allowed to speak off the record, he would tell you they've done enough. He would probably tell you they've probably done too much. And then
I would agree. That's my perspective. And yeah, maybe
he actually lives right around me. So maybe I'll walk in the dog. Maybe I'll run into him.
All right, great. We'll send a camera crew if you want. I'd love to record that one.
No, but
especially the men in black, then jumping on you and carrying you away. Right. At least we'll have it on tape.
My dog barking at him. I think he would tell us, and I think most Fed members would say they've done enough. They've done too much. The problem is, if he were to say they've done enough or even too much, and that, if they've done too much, that means the Fed has to lower rates. If the markets got wind that the Fed was thinking about lowering rates or was done hiking, that's considered bullish. Should it be? We can debate that all day, but it's considered bullish because the Fed is making policy less restrictive. They're allowing for more economic growth. Stock market would love that. Stock market would rally. The problem with that is that, and the Fed, this is the Fed's theory. The Fed believes there's a really robust relationship between the stock market and economic activity. Mm-hmm. When the stock market's going up, people feel confident. They spend more money. and it keeps, you know, it's a circle. So this is the Fed's problem. And if you mm-hmm. put yourself in Powell's shoes, he's really screwed.
Well, I mean, I think we could have said the same thing in 2018, 19 and whatnot, and it's just gotten made worse since. A couple of questions there. One is, so the economy is supposed to be the dog that wags the market tail, right? When did we get to the point where the tail is wagging the dog here?
You know what? This has been the financialization of the economy. This is the Fed ever since, you know, I mean, the Fed's always been involved, but I think starting with Greenspan and progressing, the Fed has become more and more the market. And what I mean by that is at the base of capitalism is the cost of money, is basically interest rates. What are people willing to borrow and lend money at? And where does the supply and demand of money find the right price? And that right price will shift over time based on the economy. And if it's left largely for consumers and corporations to do, it'll overshoot and undershoot, but it tends to gravitate towards the right place. Once you put the Fed into the picture, that basically dictates the price of money to markets, you get a price of money that's at one place and what should be the right price of money at another place. And you get incredible amounts of potentially speculation if the Fed's rate is lower than the real market rate. And that's what we've created. And that's largely the way the economy has operated for the last 25, 30 years. What we're seeing now, remember we talked about real rates. The instances of real rates since 2010 are almost non-existent. Mm-hmm. That means the Fed had rates below the rate of inflation. Why would anyone buy a bond below the rate of inflation? You're guaranteed to lose purchasing power, assuming inflation, you know, remains at the level it's at, right? That tells you that there's something wrong. No one should want to buy a bond where they're going to lose purchasing power. Doesn't make sense. And the reason is because there's no other alternative unless you want to buy something more risky like stocks or junk bonds or, you know, whatever it may be, real estate, which has upside, but there's also downside. So the Fed has created this this problem, and they've just propagated it more and more with each crisis or each recession. They've taken greater and greater actions. And again, you know, this is how we got here. This is the problem we have, is there's a lot of speculative debt outstanding. It's not productive debt, it's speculative debt, and it needs to be refinanced at lower rates. And
so agree with that. And so let's get to where the rubber meets the road here. And I've got a number of questions folks have asked about kind of what you think the Fed's going to do and what that means for the bond market. And we are making our way there, folks, I promise. But yes, if Powell admitted, I think I've probably done enough from here, maybe over-tightened, yeah, the expectation probably would be, oh, well, then we're going to cut rates real soon. We're going to pivot, right? And I agree, the markets would rally initially on that, right? But, you know, one thing that Powell could do is he could say, no, I'm not going to cut. I'm just going to, I said higher for longer. So we're just going to stay high mm-hmm. for longer, you know? So it's just a long pause, right? That could happen. But even if today Powell says, oh, folks, I over-tightened, I'm pivoting tomorrow. If these lag effects hit in the way in which you and I think they could, you know, I mean, history sort of shows once the Fed realizes it has over-tightened and then it starts cutting rates, it tends to tighten into a recession. And then once it sees the recession, it starts cutting rates. We usually have quarters of the markets declining after it starts the rate cuts. Right. So one of the things that's so curious to me right now is the market has been so fixated on the pivot. And in their mind, the pivot means, oh, we go straight back to 2021 and happy days are here again, right? Where anyone just looking at history briefly sees, oh, actually the pivot is where things get really bad for the markets and I should get out of the markets when the Fed announces the pivot.
Right. And the other funny thing is the yield curve. the yield curve is steeply inverted. So the yield on a two-year note is over 1% more than the yield on a 10-year note. Recessions don't really start until the yield curve uninverts. So the two-year yield is less than the 10-year yield. So you could also say the same thing. Well, that's great. The yield curve is going to uninvert. The banks have more incentive to lend money because that differential is going back in their favor. But that's just not the way it works in the real world. You know, it's not the inversion of the yield curve, it's the uninversion that signals a recession. And it's counterintuitive, just like what you were saying with the Fed cutting rates. And they're linked. The reason the yield curve's uninverting is because the Fed is cutting rates. But you know, it's
yes, in most cases. There was a chart you and I were referring to before we started filming today, and maybe I'll put it up super briefly here. It's put out by a Bloomberg analyst where he talks about the correlation between liquidity and yield curve. I'm going to call it flattening. I don't know why he sort of refers to it in the article as steepening. But basically, the chart that he shows basically says when liquidity is on the rise, like it seems to be right now, eventually the yield curve kind of flattens along with it. And what he is saying is like you're saying, Michael, you know, the yield curve uninverts usually by the short end of the curve coming down as the Fed cuts rates. Mm-hmm. He's saying it doesn't look like anytime soon the Fed's going to be cutting anytime soon. But if this historic relationship maintains going forward, then we're going to see this flattening basically by the longer end of the curve coming up. And I'm not trying to say that that's necessarily what you're predicting. Right. I'm just saying that there are two ways these yield curves can uninvert. And presumably, maybe they have different outcomes depending upon how the uninversion happens.
Right. So the curve is going to uninvert, right? We know that will happen. That has always happened. The banks are going to be out of business if it doesn't happen. It may take 5 years, but it's not a sustainable yield curve, given the way that this country and really how the rest of the world banks, borrows money, lends money, et cetera. So the yield curve can uninvert, like you said, two ways. If this is the 10-year, this is the 2-year right now. It's at a higher level, right? The 10-year can rise in yield, or the 2-year can drop in yield. Traditionally, it's the drop in the 2-year with some drop in the 10-year, but a large drop in the 2-year as the Fed cut rates. So we go back to where we're at now, 2-year, 10-year. 10-year rises, right? 10-year is already around 4%. Mortgage rates are already at 7%.
Car loans. 7.22 as of the taping here.
7.22, right? Car loans are 6, 7, 8%. Corporate loans are anywhere from 5 to, you know, depending on the credit quality, you know, within reasonable credit quality, 7%. So now you're saying that if the Fed's going to do nothing, the 2-year rate isn't going anywhere, right? If the market thinks the Fed's going to be on hold for 2 years, the 2-year rate's going to be stuck at, you know, 5, 5.25, wherever it is. Meaning the 10-year rate, if it's going to invert, is going to 5.5, 6, meaning that mortgage rates are going 8 or 9%. Auto loans are going to be double digits. Some triple B rated companies are going to be paying 8, 9, 10% for money. So I think if that happens, and who knows, it could happen, the Fed's going to drop this rate in a hurry and this rate will follow because we're going to be in a deep recession. So I think initially, maybe it uninverts. I don't think that's going to happen. But if it does, the drop in yields for both short and long term will be significant, which I think happens regardless. But that's, you just, we can't continue with rates at these levels or higher. And it's not, the Fed funds rate doesn't affect much. It's, you know, the 5-year, the 10-year rates. That's where people borrow money. That's where companies borrow money. That's where the biggest effect is going to be felt. So as longer term rates are popping up here, again, it's another headwind to the economy.
Yeah, another headwind to the economy. The way I sort of think about it, just to go back to our Wile E. Coyote analogy and all the anvils and everything, it's just the higher rates go, it's like the stronger the force of gravity that's pulling everything to Earth.
Right.
Yeah. And that, so that's why you can hang in the air longer and his impact's going to be more forceful.
And that's why I use that term economic physics, right? Because it's really physics. It just is what it is. It's, you can't really get around it.
Right. You can't use accounting gravity doesn't trickery go away. To get around it.
Unless we go to the moon somehow, gravity's with us.
Right. And look, there's a lot that can be done with accounting chicanery and, you know, changing definitions of things and things like that. But we're talking about the actual physical laws that you really can't get away from. And I think I might have misspoken there. The gravitational pull will let the coyote hang in the air for less long. And when he hits, he's going to hit with more force. Same thing with all the anvils and pianos and everything. All right. So let's get into the meat of it here then, which is, okay, so what does this mean for investors, right? As you've done a really good case of making here, which is just the global economy can't withstand the cost of capital that we have right now, right? And if that cost of capital gets even higher, it just brings in the reckoning date and maybe makes the damage even worse. And TBD, how much higher rates will go from here. What are you planning for? How are you managing capital here? And specifically, we've had you on this program, you know, a few times over the past year, and you have, I think the last time you were on the channel, I think it was at our spring conference, you had basically said, hey, I think, you know, this is about as high as rates are going to go. I think we had even come down a bit from the highs, and you had said, hey, you know, they're probably likely to start heading lower from here. We've now had this sort of resurgence. Do you see this as being relatively short-lived, or has something changed since your last appearance on the channel that changes your outlook for bonds?
Short-lived. You know, we were talking about the five-year real rate at 2.1%. Last 10 years, or last pre-pandemic 10 years, it's been zero or below. I have no doubt it gets to zero or below. And I think that's a combination of inflation falling, inflation expectations falling, and yields falling. So I think there's still tremendous upside in bonds, longer term bonds, but we just have to wait out these lag effects. Now, the nice thing is we're getting paid 4 or 5% to wait it out. So if yields go nowhere, you still at least get to make 4 or 5% while you're waiting. But, you know, whether it happens a month from now or 6 months from now, I don't know. Again, it's all these different things affecting lag effect are incredibly difficult to quantify. So,
okay. Let me summarize for a second so you can clarify the remaining answer. So it sounds like you're saying you see a lot of opportunity in bonds as interest rates come back down, as yields come back down. You don't know exactly when that's going to happen yet. When you feel confident it is, you're going to go further out in duration on your bond portfolio. And that's because when yields go down, the price of bonds go up. That's the seesaw relationship between interest rates or yields and bond prices. And that effect of prices going up is felt more dramatically the further out you go on the risk curve, or I'm sorry, on the duration curve.
Right.
But because you don't yet know, you don't have a ton of confidence yet that that moment is here yet, the bulk of the capital you've got invested in bonds is sitting in the safety of the short end of the curve where you're getting paid a nice 5%+ just to sort of sit and wait. Did I summarize it correctly?
Yeah. But even bonds, you know, longer term bonds are paying 4% to wait. So you're getting paid to wait across the curve. You're not getting paid as much to wait in a 10-year as a 2-year, but you're getting paid to wait. And the problem is there's an old saying that the Fed funds take the steps up and the elevator down. Mm-hmm. So if you look at a history of Fed funds, they go 25, they go 50, they wait a meeting, they raise another 25, 50. They were a little more aggressive this time. It was a steep stair step versus kind of the normal stair step. But when they start easing, they drop rates. They're going to drop rates significantly and quickly. They'll do intra-meeting moves. They're not going to wait for the next meeting. They're not going to be afraid to drop by 50, 75, 1% at each meeting. And again, possibly go between meetings. So the problem with the trade is that you kind of have to be in it to take advantage of it because, you know, like the last two times real yields, well, the last in 2019, 2018, the real yield on the five-year note was a little over 1%. This is pre-pandemic. We're not talking pandemic here. That was in mid-early 2019. By the end of 2019, the real yield was below zero. And it was almost all due to declining yields. So yields fell by 1% on a five-year note without a recession. This was, again, before the pandemic started in February. That's a big move for no recession because the Fed started cutting rates.
Right.
And then, you know, you go back to 2007, that real yield dropped 2% in a matter of months. So it's the kind of trade you want to be on before it starts, but timing, the point to get on, is going to be very difficult. And, you know, unfortunately, you got to kind of, you know, weather the storm, you know, the storm a little bit, but you are getting paid a nice coupon at this point to weather it.
Which is actually nice. Now, the risk, I just want to make sure folks are fully aware of this. The risk is if you go out further on the duration curve in bonds, and yields go up, then your bond is going down in value, right? So part of this is saying, hey, if I'm buying the 10-year right now and it's returning 4%, it's nice. I'm getting paid 4% a year to wait to see, you know, for this repricing that I'm looking for. But if the yield, I'm just not saying it's going to, but let's say it goes up to 6% on the 10-year, you're going to lose a lot of value in that bond.
Right.
Now, the good news with a bond is you can hold it to maturity, but you're basically saying, okay, that capital's stuck for the next 10 years in that bond if rates ever don't come down. Now, I don't think you nor I think rates are going to not come down in the next 10 years.
Right.
But of course, that's even magnified the further you go out. If you buy a 30-year bond, you know, obviously it gets hurt even more. So part of this is the calculus of just how close to the end do we think we are, right? Right now, just asking you to kind of just spitball, Michael, of the money that you are putting into the bond trade, what percentage of it is sitting in shorter duration that's waiting to go longer duration when you feel more confident that the time is right?
Two-thirds, three-quarters. Okay.
All right. So you're two-thirds, three-quarters in the short end.
Mm-hmm.
And you plan to move when things go green and you think, okay, this is the time to do it. How much of that two-thirds to three-quarters are you going to shift?
I don't know, because we don't know how the government reacts. If yields start dropping quickly and the government starts talking about stimulus, then we have inflation problems and we may want to just take advantage of it in 5 or 10 years. If we think we're going into a full-blown recession and there's no chance the government's really going to respond forcefully, we want to be in all 30 years. So you just have to play it as it comes to you, because these players, the Fed, the government, are extremely powerful and can have a big effect on what happens with yields. So, you know, one of the things we've been trying to do is a laddered portfolio. So, you know, we have exposure to 2 years, we have exposure kind of 5 years and money market stuff. So you can kind of, and again, the 5 year at a, you know, the 2 year, 2 year has a yield over 5%. In, you know, 2 years ago, that yield was close to 0%.
Mm-hmm.
So you can make 5%. And if the yield drops to 0% a year from now, you're going to make an additional 10%, maybe a little bit less than that. That's a nice return for a very short 2-year note. So there's opportunity across the curve. Some of it depends on how much risk short-term, you know, risk you want to take, i.e. the risk being that 10-year yields go from 4% to 6%, which I can't rule out. I don't know what's going to happen. But again, at the end of the day, the economy cannot withstand interest rates where they're at, certainly not higher. And at the end of the day, I see no reason why inflation won't be 2% or below and why yields won't be below at 2% or below as well.
Okay. You're underscoring the value for why we have you and your partner Lance on this channel week after week here, because the calculus does depend upon what's happening in real time as well.
Right.
So having you guys kind of update us on what you're seeing, you know, in real time is super useful. And as Lance said at the beginning of this year, you know, 2023 was kind of going to kind of be the year of the audible. And it certainly has been so far and probably will continue to be. To a certain extent, though, are we at, like, the markets don't give you a lot of periods of high confidence in something, right? You always want to wait for the high confidence trade, mm-hmm. right? I'm wondering if this isn't one of those moments where, as you and I have been discussing, the economy just can't sustain yields at this level, right? The cost of capital is just too high for the global economy to run sustainably, given how it's currently structured. Right. So the odds of yields going lower over time are pretty good. We know the policymakers are going to have to beat a retreat at some point in time, mm-hmm. right? Bonds are now yielding an awful lot more than they have in the past, right? And so you have a moment to get in where you have a high confidence that the value of the bonds are going to go up. And even if you decide not to sell them, you're going to be getting a return that we haven't seen for years.
Right.
You know, I don't know how many years it's been. I mean, a lot, decade plus.
Right.
Right. So you're going to get paid 4%+ when the market's going to be yielding 2 or less potentially at some point. Right. So it's no matter how you want to play it, hold it, sell it. You've got pretty good odds of this money doing you pretty well right now.
I agree. And, you know, it's, but we're not in a vacuum. So what I would counter you is say, well, what about stocks? Stocks traditionally yield 7%, 8%, 9% on average, right?
Yep.
Well, is that enough of a premium over 4% or 5%? You know, we can debate that all day and look at historical. And right now the answer is historically, that's a very low premium. But you have to look at valuations on stocks. And valuations are very high, which portend low rates of return in the future. So, you know, you can make a case that what traditionally 7-8% returns may only be 4-5% returns for stocks over the next 10 years. So do you want to buy a 10-year bond at 4% or a stock that ultimately yields 4%?
Right, with a lot more risk in it.
With a lot more risk. So that's kind of a no-brainer. Sleep at night and buy the bond. But, and this is where it gets difficult being a money manager. The stock market is very bullish now. And there are some opportunities worth taking advantage of. And we are invested in the stock market. And we've been slowly adding to our exposure because in the short run, it's not about all these fundamentals and not about this gloomy picture I've been painting for an hour, right? It's about momentum. It's about investor sentiment. And as long as there's a willing buyer, the price doesn't matter. And that's the market we're in right now. And there are times where you have to put aside your gloomy outlook and kind of hold your nose and understand that nothing's permanent. You can sell something the day after you buy it, 2 weeks after you buy it, but that the market, the stock market is bullish and there are some opportunities at the moment. How long they last, I don't know. You know what my long-term outlook is. You know what I think about the economy. It's not the kind of position I would buy today and not look at for 3 years. So I think that's not a great situation. But you know, you have to balance all this stuff out and think about what am I doing today? And that's why putting all your money into stocks or all your money into bonds is not a good idea. It's a good idea to diversify between the two.
So totally agree. And diversification with everything you said there, the key thing you're underscoring here for me is, you know, I beat the drum every week on this channel about that the vast majority of people who view these videos should be working with a professional financial advisor, just right. In general, right? It's specifically one that takes into account all the macro issues that we're talking about here, right? But I know there's a lot of DIY investors that watch the program too and are using this information to influence their own decision-making. And so one thing you really got to figure out here is what kind of investor are you, right? Mm-hmm. So I talked about what you were just talking about there, Michael, with Lance last week. And I didn't like this analogy, but I still haven't thought of a better one where mm-hmm. what you're kind of saying is what Chuck Prinz was saying leading up to the global financial crisis, which is like, hey, as long as the music's still playing, you got to get on the dance floor and dance with it, right? And to a certain extent, you know, financial advisors feel a lot of pressure to do that because you're getting measured versus all sorts of benchmarks, right? And you again are trying to trade the market that you have, right? But as an investor, you just need to ask yourself, like, what do you value more, right? Like, do you value safety, capital preservation? Like, do you, if you're okay with not getting the maximum return the market might have this year, but you can sleep at night knowing that you're not going right. to be putting a massive percent of your portfolio at risk, then you can kind of go heavy bonds and right. sleep at night and not worry too much, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of it is risk management. And if you're willing to look at your portfolio every, not every day, but every, you know, frequently, and set up risk levels. So if the market drops to this level, I'm going to sell X percent. If my stock goes to this level, I'm going to sell some. And be good about keeping those risk levels. You can participate and you can limit your losses. And, you know, you can use options. There's more trickier ways to hedge as well. And you don't have to be fully invested. We're not fully invested in stocks. We also own stocks in general that have lower beta. They're more conservative, pay higher dividends in general. So, you know, there's various ways to express, you know, an equity position. You know, and if you go back and look, in 2000 to 2003, small stock value stocks did very well, despite the broad indexes losing 50 plus percent and the major stocks getting hammered. So, you know, it's you have to manage your positions. You have to set risk tolerances. You have to understand your own weaknesses, and you have to have a short-term outlook to some degree. If you're going to be trading your position and going back and forth between different types of stocks and bonds, or you can take a longer term approach and tell you what the long term returns, what we think they're going to be, and probably sleep at night a little better, but potentially give up some returns because there are great opportunities in the short run.
Right. And so, you know, as you're talking about, okay, so you got to, you know, watch the market closely. You've got to set your risk parameters, maybe use options for hedging. Yeah, as you're kind of putting all those requirements in, and I agree with every one of them, the universe of people that like really fit that mold gets smaller and smaller and right. smaller because most right. people have real lives, right? They've got a job. They've got to devote the majority of their attention to. They've got families, et cetera, right? So all I'm saying is, you know, folks watching, the first question you should ask yourself is like, what kind of investor am I? Like, what am I playing for here? And if I'm not a highly experienced DIY investor who can do all the things that Michael's saying there, then just be honest with yourself and say, look, that's not me. And if it's not you, then you should either come up with a very simple DIY approach for yourself, or, and this is why I keep hammering the drum of professional financial advisors, is you should find an advisor whose approach matches your personality and your goal set and give them the keys. Now make sure it's an advisor who keeps you well informed and all that type of stuff, but it's much easier. And being really honest, I that's what I do. Even though I follow the markets every day, I'm too busy interviewing all these guys right. to be making trades and, you know, putting all this, keeping all this in my head and making, you know, decisions in real time. I've really given that to an advisor I trust. And I just did the work up front to evaluate a bunch of different advisors and pick the advisor that I felt was the best for me. And that's all I'm really trying to get people to do.
And it's like most professions. Like when I go see doctors, I don't diagnose myself. I don't know what's going on. I go to doctors that tell me what's going on and that I can trust and that I like their approach and I'm comfortable with their approach. So, you know, we all have our specialties. Mine just happens to be in money management and economics and, you know, financial outlooks and that kind of thing. You know, so go, you know, just like you do with everything else, if you don't think you can do it yourself or you're not comfortable doing it yourself, find someone that you can work with.
Great. All right. So getting to where the rubber meets the road here, with your, in the bullseye of your professional expertise, what trades have you guys made in the past week? How are you surfing these current market conditions?
We have been slowly adding a little bit of equity exposure. Nothing substantial. We added, I think, 2% of equity exposure. We bought a REIT and we bought a tech company. You know, but we're kind of laying low. We're we see the stock market on a short-term sell signal. We think it could correct 5, 7, maybe even 10%. Possibly that started on Thursday with that decent sized decline. So we, you know, we're kind of waiting for a sell signal to add a little more equity exposure. We're not really doing much with bonds. We're just, we have decent positions right now. We're waiting. And, you know, when we see this, stock markets are set up nicely here above key moving averages and above other key supports, so that if those supports are broken, those are nice risk tolerance levels for us that we can sell or reduce exposure. So it's a pretty comfortable place to get long, because we know if the market starts breaking down, we have key levels that will help us get back out of the market.
All right, great. And so, you know, as I said, we have you and your partner, Lance Roberts, coming on this channel week after week after week to keep people informed here. So if indeed things either drop to those key sell signals and you start selling, you know, you or Lance will let us know on this channel. If they break through other technical indicators that suggest they could run even higher, you're going to let us know that as well. So again, it's super useful for you guys letting us look over your shoulder here at your trades. And just to help give you guys a little bit of a plug, your SimpleVisor service, actually, if folks sign up for that, they actually get alerted to your trades as they kind of happen in real time. Is that correct?
Right. So all our portfolios are on SimpleVisor. Anytime we do a trade, we post it to SimpleVisor. It sends an email out as well. And we are working on texting that as well. Right now, Lance and I get texts, but it's still in beta mode. But hopefully over the next few weeks, we can roll that out. And you also have access to all the tools that we use to help determine what's cheap, what's rich, what sectors, what type of stocks do we want to move to or away from, et cetera.
Okay, great. And I'll just put it up on the screen here, but it's simplevisor.com if folks want to go check that out. All right, Michael, this has been great. As far as I'm concerned, Lance can set up shop at whatever desert island he's on for this week, and we'll just have you every week going forward. I really appreciate both the time and the expertise. It's been a great conversation. Thanks so much. So in wrapping up, folks, a couple of quick updates. One is I've mentioned a couple of times our upcoming Wealthion Fall Conference. Just a reminder, the date is Saturday, October 21st. So we're still a couple of months away, but we've been having really good luck so far with getting confirmations from a really high caliber faculty. I think the highest caliber faculty that we've ever yet had. So very excited about how things are coming along. Just to let you know who's said yes so far, we have Lacey Hunt returning, and he will do one of his epic kickoffs. And if you've watched one of our conferences in the past, you know exactly what I'm talking about. That presentation, I think, is worth the cost of the event alone. He'll be followed by Jim Grant of Grant's Interest Rate Observers, really the godfather of where interest rates are headed. We'll also have Michael Kantrowitz, developer of the HOPE framework that Michael and I talked about here earlier on in this discussion. Stephanie Pomboy has said, yes, she'll be there. She'll be talking about the whole inflation-deflation tug of war. Kyle Bass has agreed to come participate. Ivy Zellman is going to come back on, give us her latest update on the housing market. Tom McClellan is agreed to come on to give us the latest on his technical analysis. We'll have Doomberg and Justin Hune talking about the energy markets with a real deep dive on investing in nuclear and what the latest outlook for that energy source is. There's a lot going on in that space. There's a number of other additional lines we have in the water. I hope to be able to announce some other really big names soon, but wanted just to let you know how this is coming along. I did forget one name, actually. We've got a great bond expert coming on to update us on bonds at the conference. It's a guy named Michael Leibowitz. He's a pretty smart guy. All right. Just to wrap things up here, just a reminder, folks, for all the reasons that Michael and I went into, so I won't continue to beat that drum. We think that most people watching this, especially if you're feeling kind of, you know, overwhelmed on how to take advantage of some of the opportunities we talked about while avoiding some of the pitfalls of these, you know, lag effect anvils and pianos and bowling balls that we're worried about. Highly recommend you work under the guidance of a professional financial advisor that takes all those macro issues into consideration. If you've got a good one who's doing that for you, building a personalized portfolio plan for you, executing it for you, and keeping you well informed along the way, you should stick with them. They're very valuable. They're extremely rare. If you've got a good one, congratulations. If you don't, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does, perhaps even Michael and Lance and their team there at Real Investment Advice, then consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the endorsed financial advisors by Wealthion. To do that, just go to wealthion.com, fill out the short form there. These consultations are totally free. They don't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these providers. They just offer it as a free public service to help as many people as possible position prudently in advance of what might be lying ahead. And with that, Michael, I just want to say thanks so much. It's been great. Like I said, again, I hope, you know, Lance extends his vacation. We get to continue having you on here in the near term. But it's been wonderful. Folks, if you enjoy these weekly market recaps, and especially have enjoyed Michael coming back on here, and you want to see him on these recaps again, please do us a favor and support this channel by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Michael, I'll let you have the last word here. Again, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It was great to be on here. And we just, yeah, respect the lag. I think that's the important part. It doesn't mean, you know, we don't know when the lag is going to hit, but just respect that it's still there.
All right. I'm kind of feeling like we should maybe get like t-shirts and hats made up with respect the lag on them.
Right. There you go.
All right, folks. Next time. If you think we should make them, let us know in the comment section below. If we get enough demand, maybe we'll do something crazy and order a few. All right. Again, Michael, thanks so much. Everyone else, thanks so much for watching.